So welcome everyone.
Hello.
Brave souls. Especially if you came from somewhere other than Manhattan, you're a very brave soul. So good evening. I think that everyone here knows the East Side Institute in some way or another, which is lovely. Since you're all invited guests, I think that you would. So all of you as invited guests to speak and develop a relationship in an hour and a half with my invited guest, Peter Smugger and Scoot. So let me tell you a little bit about Peter and about how this event got created. So Peter is the distinguished researcher.
There are others.
He is just one of many distinguished.
There aren't many.
We'll do that one again.
That's going really well.
You can see that we spent the day together. Distinguished research professor in the College of Education at the University of Georgia in Athens, Georgia. He taught high school English for 14 years before he became an academic. He's editor of dozens of academic journals and on the ed board of others, or maybe it's dozens when you put those together.
Yeah, I used to be a journal editor.
You're no longer a journal editor.
I'm the faculty advisor to a terrific graduate student edited journal at Georgia. But you should all submit your manuscripts too. But I'm on about a dozen ed boards now.
And chair of many professional organization divisions or task forces. He's won oodles of awards for research, teaching, and service. And he is the author or co-author of more than 24 books. Peter and I have come to know each other over the last 4 or 5 years, I guess, through the working together on the Cultural Historical Research Special Interest Group of the American Educational Research Association, which is a huge organization of educational researchers.
Along with Terry, we should say. Terry's
on. Yes.
We've got three of us together too.
Yes. We haven't, however, gotten to become serious students of each other's work. And I would say we're just beginning, and hopefully this will be part of, in some ways, discovering and exploring the similarities and differences, which to me is kind of one of the best parts of a relationship. I do know, however, that one direction that Peter's work took over the past 2.5 or 3 years has been to explore one of the unexplored aspects of Lev Vygotsky's work. It has been important to us at the Institute, but very few people write about it, and that is what is in his volume on the fundamentals of defectology, or special ed, or whatever you want to call it. Peter's going to speak a lot about that and what it's called and why that matters. And that's taken him to explore the concept of normalcy and how people talk about it and what they call abnormality or abnormalcy. Might have made that up. And weaving his own personal history and stories through that scholarly work. I was very inspired and impressed by those three articles that I read that came out between 2011 and I guess 2012. And it was kind of the catalyst for inviting Peter to be the first in a series of conversations that we're calling Making a Conceptual Revolution, in order to introduce people like Peter to people like you and vice versa. So I have questions that fall in different categories and many too many, and I want to turn it over to you as well. So Hopefully I will stop myself or someone will scream him. And my first question is probably better suited at the end, but I'm going to ask it now, which is, so I consider you a conceptual revolutionary, which is why you're here now in this room with these people. Do you?
Yikes.
Good.
Well,
yikes.
You know, I've read enough Bakhtin to be confident that whatever I think is derivative of what other people think, including you, of course, and people working in the Vygotskian tradition. So the work I've done drawing on his volume on defectology might look revolutionary as long as you forget that he wrote about it 80 years ago. You know, so I think that the revolution took place, it just didn't take. And so you and the other six people who have read those articles were working on the revolution. But no, I guess that would take quite a bit of chutzpah to be considered myself a revolutionary. And I think that that's for other people to call you. It's once you start calling yourself revolutionary, I think you've lost your humility. So I would never apply that term to myself. And I just don't have any distance on myself to even think about something like that.
Doesn't matter if I said conceptual revolutionary?
This is one of the you told me there would be surprise questions.
Yeah. Yeah.
I told her, as long as you don't say, ask me boxers or briefs, you can ask anything. I'm a thong guy, actually. I don't know. I've sort of dodged the first question because I just don't know. I don't know if I'm. As I said, I think that's up to other people to decide. I don't think I could begin to. I think it would be an act of hubris to call myself a revolutionary, and I'm not ready. I'm not yet to that. I haven't developed enough to think of myself in those terms.
Or aged enough. Right.
No, I've aged plenty.
Well, why don't, I mean, we could go directly to the work on defectology, which I do think is, I do think that your work has made some conceptual breakthroughs, and other people make breakthroughs and they may not be considered revolutionaries. So I think I'm not going to say what I think the revolutionariness of it is. Let's speak about it.
Let's at least get it out on the table before we decide what it is.
Great. So one of the articles was called Every Individual Has His Own Insanity. I mean, it had a subtitle after that. And you say in there that it's a quote from Vygotsky.
Right, right.
And that was so beautiful. Do you want to, can you share more of the, flesh out that quote?
Yeah, that article, I probably wrote it two or three years ago, so I have to make sure I'm getting this right. But somewhere in the volume on defectology, you talked about a certain kind of insanity. You gave it, there's an adjective that precedes it that I'm not getting. Moral insanity,
yes.
Thank you. And it referred to the lashing out by people based on the way that they're treated. And to him, this was something that everyone is prone to do. And so I sort of repurposed that phrase to challenge the whole notion of normalcy. Because that's one thing I really get at in all this writing. Just some background. I'm an old high school English teacher. A lot of what I've written is on literacy, teaching, and learning, the preparation of English teachers for teaching in the workforce, and things like that. So, my daughter is now 27, and early in her life, she just showed signs that she wasn't your ordinary kid. She was pulling her hair out. She had a tremendous number of tics, which turned out to be Tourette's syndrome. And she was very volatile. Our house was very, state of calamity when she would beam up the house, beating up people in it emotionally, beating up her brother. It was a very rough place to live. And years and years of interventions and therapies and medications and we knew that she had problems with depression. We knew she had problems with anxiety. We knew she was obsessive compulsive. You know, she would get in bed and check to see if her closet door was shut 50 or 60 times. She had something called oppositional defiance disorder. This is a great one for your parents. Where the trait that's most salient to the parent is that the kid gets off on the opposition. In other words, there's no, the parent, you try to diffuse it, but what gets a charge in her is the conflict. It's oppositional defiance disorder. We also, eventually we found out that she has Asperger's syndrome, which was kind of at the heart of all this. But one of the things that you learn as a parent when your kid goes through all this therapy is you think, are they talking about her or are they talking about me? And so, yeah, I've never bothered to get diagnosed, but there's no doubt that I have Asperger's syndrome. My wife and daughter and son will all give you an empirical verification of that claim. I also have mild Tourette syndrome. I'm highly anxious. I have an obsessive compulsive personality. And I really try to avoid the tag disorder. And I really fight against the no. People say, oh, you suffer from. And I say, no, I don't suffer from it that much. But often the people around me suffer. So there's this language that surrounds people who are different. And I'm going to bang my head on this before. That bothers me. That you're disordered, and I don't want this to be too much of a monologue, but I'll go back to the event that really started this as a crisis for me. For me, it was a breakdown. To my wife, it was a breakthrough, and I think that that's an interesting distinction. Mm-hmm. Because what happened was, I was giving a talk at a conference, a room about like this. The only difference was that I knew everyone in the room. There were my friends, some of my colleagues. It was about the friendliest audience you could imagine. But there had been hard stuff going on at home. The conference was in Denver. I didn't recognize it at the time. I had a mild panic attack on the flight. I've always been shaky about flying. And I got up and I knew something was wrong as soon as I got up there. My head started to spin. I couldn't talk. And within about 2 minutes, I was in mid-sentence and I had to leave the room. I was having this major panic attack. Is anybody, well, I don't want to put you on the spot. But if you've ever had a panic experience, it's really scary. And here I was at a professional meeting, and I had flown three graduate students, so like sitting right there. This was the first time they'd ever seen me outside the confines of my office. And I fell apart in front of them. In fact, I gave one of them my talk. It was the first time she'd ever been to a conference. But, she was and so it happened that one of my best friends was sitting right there, and he rescued the student after I had ruined her day. And I had to leave the conference earlier, and I went home, and this was the first time I'd ever been diagnosed as having severe chronic anxiety. To get here to New York from Georgia, I had to take medications to get on the flight, a drug called Xanax. To speak to you tonight without having to leave the room, I had to take a drug called Inderol. If you have trouble with panic, go get yourself some Inderol. The greatest drug. Drug ever invented, because it's a beta blocker, and so it suppresses adrenaline rushes, and that's what tightens your throat, and makes you just makes. I honestly thought I was going to die. I didn't know what was going on when I had this panic attack. So then I went back. The guy, you have to get, in order to get the medication, you have to go through a doctor, and you have to be accompanied by therapy, psychological counseling therapy. So there's some medical therapy and then counseling therapy. So there I was. My daughter and I were in the same boat all of a sudden. And because as a parent, prior to this, I had just thought, what in the hell is wrong with this kid? Or if that's what I thought sometimes, but then other times I didn't think she was so odd when my wife thought that there was something really weird about her. And I think it's because she was so much like me that I didn't think that there was anything wrong with her. And I've had this experience with other people. People say, oh, that guy is so, so weird. And I'll think, I don't see anything wrong. It's perfectly normal to me. And I think it's because I just recognize these Asperger's traits. So so this was the breakdown or breakthrough, depending on how you look at it. And it just made me more sensitive to mental health issues. And if you've got a kid like this, and my daughter was hospitalized a couple times, and this was, I think, before I had my big experience. When they hand you the sheet of paper that says says mentally ill, and you've grown up in a family socialized to think that mental illness is for weaklings, that's a really hard one. I now absolutely embrace it. But that first time I saw it on a piece of paper with my kid's name on it was a soul-crushing moment for me. And I say that to emphasize how I've been socialized to think about these things, not to make a judgment about the diagnosis. Because, I think of mentally ill, the people who walk down Fifth Avenue talking to themselves, those are mentally ill people, not my kid. So this just got me whole interested in mental health. And looking more compassionately on people who are characterized that way. You start looking at the whole language of disability, abnormal psychology. Well, who wants to be abnormal? I mean, that's a lousy word. Who wants to? And it's all deficit language. Mm-hmm. The whole approach that society takes toward people who are of a different mental health makeup is that there's something wrong with them. That individual needs to be fixed. We need to, what can we do to fix it? Let's give them drugs, that'll fix it. And I don't want to belittle that because I take Paxil every day. I mean, it's a lifesaver, and I really mean that. I think I would have had a heart attack and died if I weren't on something that tempered this high wire act that I was all the time. At the same time, I was talking about this last night, I think I have the Asperger's advantage in life because I'm a very highly focused individual. I'm in a field that, being kind of an eccentric, what do they call it? Absent-minded professor, they got all these names for academics. I think that academia is a great place for people who are mentally ill. Because we can wear plaid socks with a flannel shirt. I mean, it doesn't really matter that much as long as you can teach or whatever it is you do. I'm really rambling on this, but that's okay. So I took I started taking this more, looking very differently at mental health, and I started reading Vygotsky in the early 90s. I had gone through graduate school immersed in cognitive psychology, information processing. Cognition is all in the head. You've got this little computer up here, and it processes information, and it stores, you have memory storage, and the cog psych metaphor of the computer. That's what I based all my understandings of human cognition on, was the between the ears psychology, so called. And I'm very much an autodidact, self-taught. in Vygotsky because a friend of mine said, "Oh, you got to start reading stuff." And once I started, it was hard to turn back. And you don't just read Vygotsky; you read all the attendant literature. And right around then, there was starting to be an abundance of. When did your revolutionary psychology
start? 93.
93. So I mean, it was right around. Books like that were starting to come out, and then you can go back and start reading some of the older books. But there was one volume, and then at one point I bought, there were six collected works of Vygotsky. I bought them all at exorbitant prices.
Yes.
Well, try buying them now, though.
I don't.
Like
I use
$250 for a book. I think they stopped printing them, and they're off the charts. So there was this one, Defectology. Who would ever read a book on defectology? And I remember, were you at the 1994 conference in Russia, in Moscow? Were you there?
Not in Iskor, different in Vygotsky.
This was the one in, it was in Galicia.
No.
You weren't there. Okay, so one of the things that they did, after the conference we went on some bus tour of the scenic places around Moscow. My Stalinist architecture. So one place we went to was the Defectology Institute, or a school that was a defectology school. And I just thought, why are we going to a defectology school? What is it?
Wasn't Sigouris, of course.
I don't know.
Okay.
It was 20 years ago. And there were people complaining, and I wasn't, you walk around, and it was just like everything else in what had been the Soviet Union. It had been recently built and was falling apart, but I didn't really get much out of it, because I didn't really know what, you hear the word defectology, and you think, are these people kidding? Defects? So it turns out that it's either a bad word or a bad translation or something, because it really refers to kids who are blind, and this is attendant reading I did when I finally did start reading this volume.
The deaf blind,
cognitively impaired.
Yeah.
But a lot of it followed from the fact that there had been so much war in Russia, and there are things that I had never put together. If your sense of, at least my sense of history, is often very compartmentalized. So, for instance, maybe, I don't know about you, maybe you're much better at integrating your knowledge than I am. I knew that there was a Bolshevik revolution in 1917. It's only recently that I figured out that that took place during World War I. What? You overthrow your own government while you're at war with Germany? I mean, so there had been almost constant warfare in Russia from 1905. The first Russian Revolution, they tried to overthrow the Romanovs in 1905 because they were at war with Japan and the people didn't like the way the war was being conducted. So war with Japan, Russian Revolution number one, 10 years of repression, or no, actually fewer than that, World War I, Russian Revolution, and my sense of the Russian Revolution was, oh, the Bolsheviks, out with the Tsars, in with the Bolsheviks, smooth sailing. But it was 7 years before the Bolsheviks actually won, because they overthrew the Tsars. But then they had years and years of, first, there was still World War I going on, but all it did was create a power vacuum. And there was a civil war with different groups vying for control of Russia. So it wasn't until about 1924, 1925, till the 20 years of almost continual warfare ended, and what they had was a lot of beat up people, a lot of kids who had gone deaf from bombs exploding around them. They were maimed from, combat, from being around combat. And so finally they had more or less a stable society, and what do you do with these kids? And that's really was when the field of defectology was born. And it was, as Lois said, it's sort of like special ed, but it was special ed with a real cause. There were all these damaged children. And the, so this is what's, this is revolutionary. I can call Vygotsky revolutionary because the ideas still sound revolutionary because they're so different from how we think about things here. His perspective was, you don't, the point of treating children who are different is not to fix the different kid. It's to change what goes on around the kid so that the kid doesn't feel different. That's revolutionary. It would, it sounds revolutionary now, because that's not how we think of it. We give the kid Ritalin. We put cochlear implants in people's ears. We don't change how people are treated. And so, let's say that deafness is the primary disability, and I use the term disability cautiously. To Vygotsky, that's not the problem. The problem is the secondary disability, how people treat that person. And there are different kinds of treatment that he found problematic. One was rejection treated as deficient. But the other was just as bad, which is pity. You know, all of them are belittling. All strip the person of self-esteem. And I don't use self-esteem in the modern self-esteem sense of everybody feeling good about themselves no matter what. You know, like the Little League team that I coached, where the kids would never show up to practice and they all wanted a trophy at the end. So that's the self-esteem movement kind of run amok. So, but it was, you know, that real sense of worth as a human being that was denied people because they were pitied or they were scorned because they were different and deficient. And so that's the fundamental premise of his approach to defectology, or the treatment of people who are different. And that's an idea I've adapted that idea to mental health issues. But it's certainly not something I don't think I would ever in my lifetime have thought of this. Of my point of the difference being not the problem, but how society views people like that. Now, you can't ignore the fact that some people with mental illnesses are, frankly, dangerous. So, you know, one of the tricks of all this is, where do you draw the line in terms of either creating a functional social setting that's accommodating and supportive, and protecting people from someone who might injure them. And I know people who've had to be separated from their own children because their children were so violent that they were scary, and the parents felt very, very threatened being around them. Don't ask me what to do about that. And I don't know. I don't believe in lobotomies, but I just don't know what to do.
Can I ask you a question?
No.
So I get the impression. I want to know if you. It sounds like you're conflicted on this issue.
Oh, I very am, yeah.
I understand. You've said in one of your papers that mental health is a issue of multiculturalism and diversity.
Mm-hmm.
And your concept, or the words you want to use, are extra normal.
Right.
Instead of different or ill. And you're using the word mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
So, Is that just an ordinary language, mental illness, or...?
Yeah, and, you know, you've caught me in my own trap.
We're all in that trap.
You know, because you sort of default to the language that
yeah.
you've been surrounded by.
Right.
So you're absolutely right. In my writing, when I'm more careful, I'll spend 10 minutes trying to rearrange a sentence so that it doesn't include any kind of deficit thinking. So, but, you know, when I'm not thinking about
yeah.
it, I resort, you know, I subconsciously employ the very terms that I argue against. So
mm-hmm.
I appreciate your stepping in on that.
Can I just ask a follow-up question to that? Earlier you said something about how you were embracing, I don't think that was the word you used, but your sense of yourself having an illness or your daughter. So I think there seemed to be something you were doing with that. But now you're saying that you think that perhaps you should be careful not to use that word.
Well, yeah, and again, it's the spontaneous, in spontaneous speech, I don't always articulate things the way I would when I type. You know, I have the option, I can revise when I write. And believe me, newspapers are heavily revised. You know, because sometimes you don't even see yourself using deficit language until you go back and reread. It's embedded. So I think that those are good points and just reinforces, you know, I probably am more self-conscious about this than most people, and I still fall into my own trap. So, you know, for that I apologize, and so I appreciate the correction on that.
Could you, go ahead.
I just, my experience of how you're using the language, I feel provoked by all of it, which I really like. Mm-hmm. I actually like that what you're talking about is challenging this normalcy thing and the disorder language, but never mind the language, the whole activity, conception, institutionalization of disorder.
Yeah.
And you're saying that you and your daughter are, you know, mentally ill. I like that. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's a provocation to us to look at the totality of the whole thing. So I enjoyed it.
Oh, thanks. Well, you wouldn't always enjoy it if you were around it more.
Oh, I'm around myself enough.
It's coming from that place, too.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. So, yeah, I hope you don't mind if I just rattle on here. But I've used this term, the Asperger's advantage, and people choke short about that. But I'm in a line of work that rewards narrow people. Right?
Yeah. Yes.
So if you have Asperger's syndrome, you are a very focused person. Sometimes people are talking to you and you don't even hear them. You know, my wife will walk in while, you know, and it used to be she'd try to talk to me, now she looks in and she not today. And if you're highly anxious the way I am, you can't leave things unfinished. There's this, if things pile up on me at all, I'm really agitated. So I finish things, and so I'm highly focused and I'm a finisher. Oh, that's a good thing to have if you're in higher ed. And I don't want to sound like this borders on braggadocio, so I don't want to. I do run that risk, but I think I've averaged 7 publications a year for over a quarter century, going back to when I was a graduate student. Lois mentioned I'm on a dozen editorial boards. Last year, I've reviewed, I think, 61 articles for journals, and I usually had the review back within 2 days of receiving the manuscript. That's the only way you can do that many, by not letting there be any pile-up on those things. And if you write for publication, you know that it could take 8 months or a year and a half, you know, and some people just let them pile up. But it's not within me to let that even happen, because I'll go crazy. So there's this, you know, that's not a disorder. I look pretty good on my annual reviews because of the things that make me mentally ill by some definitions. So, you know, it's, you know, so what, am I abnormal? You know, I probably am abnormal, but I don't consider myself so in a deficit way. At the same time, I have to acknowledge that there was a time that I broke down, that I had such a, I had a complete meltdown that I've had to, and I've had to resort to medication to assist me with that. So, in, you know, all this, there are two words. One is extra normal, being extra normal. That's much better than abnormal, don't you think? There's something extra about you. But you know, the term extra also means outside, outside the norm. There's a word in that Asperger's people use to describe the rest of y'all, as we say in the South, all y'all. And that term is neurotypical. They refer to those other people as neurotypicals. And it's true, too, that we can't understand social conventions and why people waste so much of their time on them. You know, primping before the mirror for an hour. Just get to work, will you? You know, why go through, what does it matter whether you say hello or if people ask me, how you doing? And I'll say, I'm not supposed to do that, you know, to give a real answer. And so we wonder why people, there's so much masquerading going on. And, you know, I say that, you know, it's interesting that we're interested in performance also, because there are all these performances that we just can't do. I feel really disingenuous if you perform in these superficial social situations where you're just supposed to say, hi, how are you doing? Great. And, you know, and walk on. If you actually stop and say, well, geez, you're messing everything up. So there's a term that I started using that's a play on that, which is neuroatypical. So that's a different way. It's a less pathologized term than deficient or disordered or something like that. And one of the arguments I've made is, I think I follow a different order. I don't think it's a disorder. Because when I look at my annual review, it's enviable to my normal colleagues. In fact, some of them are downright resentful about it. And again, I don't want to say that in a bragging way. It's a fact of my life.
Can I ask a question about that, though?
Yeah.
So my recollection is that Vygotsky talks about compensating for the extra normal, to mix the languages of Vygotsky and you. And you had been speaking about minimizing or eliminating changing how people relate to people, that the stigma is the thing.
Yeah.
And so I guess I'm asking a question about my understanding had to do with this compensation, but also that it's not just how people relate, but it's literally the environment that you're in.
Yeah, you know, if you embrace Vygotsky, you're talking about settings all the time. You're talking about culture and history and social interactions, not individuals. Although I think Vygotsky also talked about individual and context, and so it's not. I consider myself Vygotskyan and not an activity theorist, because I think the collective is important, but I don't think that that's the unit. At least that's not the unit that interests me. What I see is the individual in that collective. Because I don't think all individuals in the collective are the same. I think a lot of us are pretty different. So I'm very comfortable just referring to myself as a Vygotskyan, and I've completely gotten away from activity theory as a claim to what I do. And I don't know those in the room whether you even know what I'm talking about when I say these things. But if you're familiar with the psychological terminology, one is more concerned with the collective as what they call the unit of analysis, the group. And I actually do case studies of individuals, and I try to contextualize them. And that's why I consider myself more Vygotskyan than activity theorist. But let me just see if we're using the same terms in the same way. This compensatory aspect refers to Vygotsky's reference to roundabout mediational means. And I'll give a very simple example. If someone's blind, you don't try to make them see better. You give them a different way of seeing, say by using Braille. So they read by using Braille. That's a classic compensatory thing. And this is just another one of those historicizing things when you think of, you know, trying to integrate your knowledge of history. He was a contemporary of Helen Keller. Helen Keller was a big example of his. And so she was, and he wasn't drawing on, you know, when I think of Helen Keller, I think of something from 100 years ago or a movie. But this was something happening at the same time. You know, this was a contemporary example to him. So that's probably the easiest illustration of that to for people to get. And so you have to use your imagination to think, well, what are workarounds for people with other kinds of points of difference, say those related to mental health differences? And how can the people surrounding them legitimize those other, you know, these other means of engaging with the world? Not pity them, not look down on them, not consider them to be deficient. I'm still working on the solution to that question. This is something that is, I've only recently turned my attention to in an analytic way. So I don't, you know, I've hardly solved these problems, but I'm thinking about them and trying to write my way through them.
I'm thinking that some people here probably have some
thoughts
about that in particular, and maybe some examples.
An observation. I'm also an undergrad at the University of Georgia. I'm an English teacher and teacher trainer, and I've worked with the English Language Fellows Program. But I was, I spent time training teachers in both Cambodia and Rwanda, two countries that, of course, have had much civil strife.
Genocide, sure.
And something you said earlier made me realize, like in Cambodia, many people of a certain age are missing limbs,
yep.
But that's normal.
Mm-hmm.
And in Rwanda, many people of a certain age are orphaned or
mm-hmm.
adult orphans or missing many members of their family.
Yeah.
And again, that's normal in that society.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of, you know, at my time there, from what I could perceive the relationships and situation, they certainly weren't shunned or pitied because in some
mm-hmm.
ways they were such a, maybe a majority of the younger generation coming up, quite a large population of younger people. But if not a majority, it's certainly a very large segment of the population. So they weren't marginalized. They were active members and adults in society. It's interesting how.
Yeah. There's, and one of the phrases he uses is that he probably uses the term defectology. It is a social problem. You know, and that's, you know, if you can just kind of file that one away, these are social problems, not problems of the individual. The person, he says the blind person doesn't know that everybody else can see.
Mm-hmm.
It's only when people start treating that person
mm-hmm.
as weird
yeah.
that the person starts to think that he or she is weird. And so there has to be a way, and part of the solution is educating everybody else. So, you know, this is not the way we think about stuff in America. I've never heard of people say, well, no, I shouldn't say that. My former dean is a guy named Andy Horn, a really good guy. And when was the last time anyone said that about his dean? But he was a bullying researcher. He remains a bullying researcher. And all of his efforts are on student climate.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not to fix the bully, it's to create a different
mm-hmm.
climate in which people can engage with school together. Yeah.
I find everything you're saying very interesting, but I was thinking about what you were talking about earlier about, you know, conforming to the how are you, I'm fine, etc.
Yeah.
So made me think about a column that was in the New York Times recently when the writer was talking about Americans and Russians here, Russian immigrants and
mm-hmm.
Americans, and that and how Russians are, the Russian culture is when someone says, how are you, you're going to tell them all your complaints. Whereas the Americans say fine. And so
and my family is from Belarus. So.
So, you know, I was talking about how, you know, the Russians collectively and individually think that the Americans are rude as hell, and the Americans think the Russians are obnoxious when this, you know, this
oh, fascinating. You know, there's another, there's a study, there's a guy named Tim or Tom Kochman. This is actually an old study, but it's just one of these right-on studies, you know, just kind of hits it out of the park. He did a study of a community, like town hall meetings almost, in Chicago that involved black and white residents. And it was the people in the community were well-educated. Both, you know, all the people who attended these meetings were well-educated. And in their interactions, there was a tremendous amount of dissatisfaction with each racial group of the other. The white participants, you know, I guess this was done in post hoc interviews or something, would say that the black participants were irrational and overly emotional, kind of raised their voices too much, kind of rude, and weren't, you know, they weren't thinking through these problems. The black participants would say the white people had no commitment because they lacked passion. So it's very similar, you know, these are culturally constructed notions of appropriate public interaction, with each group looking down on the other for their conduct. And I think that that's what you're, similar to what you're saying. Yeah.
And I mean, I think to follow up on the disability question, I think that's what plays out in education and educational times, you know, where you have one culture, the teachers, and you have the other culture, the students, yeah. You know, and when you throw disability into the equation, specifically something like autism, other differences of kind of neurocognitive kind of differences, I think you end up setting up a culture in which the people that are considered disordered are continuously trying to be fixed by the ordered, you know, and that's the problem.
Well, and, you know, I'm a school guy, so I've seen a lot of these things play out in schools, and so if you think, an example I like to give is, it's well documented that black kids are suspended disproportionately to their numbers in school relative to white kids. So one interpretation that's very popular in the South is that these black kids are, there's something wrong with them. That's why they get suspended all the time. Another is that the two cultural groups construct public discourse in different ways, appropriate cultural discourse. And if you look at the way and I don't want to overgeneralize, but black churches tend to be pretty rambunctious. You know, the preachers, if the audience isn't participating enough, they're, you know, things like, y'all don't hear me, and then they start, you know, calling out and things like that. So that the expectation is that you're going to have side conversations, you're going to call out, you're going to be loud, you're going to be passionate, you're going to be involved. You go to school, you got to sit there and shut your mouth. You got to act properly. And so, you know, this is not a case of mental health difference. It's a case of cultural difference and expectations and social condition for what is appropriate. And the dominant group is always going to get control over who's good and who's bad in those situations. And it also applies to mental health issues. I've studied the character education movement in the United States. One thing that's character education. The federal government funded, and I think it was during the Bush administration, that you could apply for grants, federal grants, to support the teaching of character in schools, of good character. In Georgia, there were 27 character traits identified as part of the character education program. One was respect for the creator. Another one, and this is even my favorite more than that one, was cheerfulness. So a lot of these, and that pisses me off, So, you know, oh, and respect for authority. So I think respect for authority.
You got to throw that one.
Oh, okay, so important. And so I think to myself, well, my grandparents were Jews in, you know, Tsarist, you know, in Belarus, which was the Pale of Settlement, where all the Jews were expelled to so that you could run pogroms on them nice and easily. And they up and left. They didn't have any respect for authority. And they probably weren't cheerful. But they're my people. And I'm glad they did. So, you know, so they exhibited courage in doing that, which is another thing that's on all these character education traits. So they're all cultural constructions. But here's the reason I raise that is in all the literature on character education, the only study that mentions mental health is the one that Joel Taxel and I did. Saying, where's the mental health stuff? Because kids act out in school for reasons other than being bad. Right? And sometimes they have oppositional defiance disorder, you know, or something like that. Or Tourette's, you know, they might yell out some profanity. They might, you know, there are lots of different reasons that kids might do things that are considered inappropriate. One being, they are put together a little bit differently. So it's not even, so the conduct is constructed as a matter of sort of good or evil, not kind of mental health norm, which I think is a great part of how people act in school. Yeah?
I just want, before you were talking about, I can't remember if it was blind or whatever, that the individual, it doesn't know something's wrong until the collective.
Right.
And when you're talking about, like, and then now you're talking about, let's say, poor kids, what's wrong with them, maybe they have this or that, but it's not as opposed to, what's the environment that they're in that might create that response, whatever, I don't know, something about that was interesting. It seems like one place, it's the collective that's doing something, and another one, it's the individual that's doing it.
Well, in whose terms? When you say it's the individual and it's the collective, are you, who's making those judgments in how you're characterizing
it? Well, I guess I was hearing you, actually.
Oh, okay.
You were saying that, let's just say poor kids for a minute, maybe they're acting out because they have something else wrong with them, but it wasn't so much posed in. Maybe things are happening in poor communities because society's constructed in such a way that these kids are being fucked over and they're responding to it.
Well, I probably trivialized it. So when you think of the collective, it can be collective writ large. It could be the collective in, you know, in a room size. So, you know, again, I'm still working my way through this, and that is also, that involves both my thinking and my phrasing. So sometimes I need to be reminded of whether I'm contradicting myself or whether I sound as though I'm contradicting myself. So I appreciate the point.
If I'm understanding this, let me see if I can, see if I understand your response.
And don't assume that I understand what I'm talking about.
I won't understand. I never understand what I'm talking about. So there's, I think that you were assuming, taking for granted, that it is the environment and how kids are responding, especially poor kids or
at least in that example.
Yes. And going back to the earlier thing and what you've been very interested in right now is that they could be extra normal. Some of those kids can also be extra normal.
Oh, yeah.
Is that, were you?
I wasn't pushing it into that. I wasn't pushing it into there, but I think that, yes, that's.
Because I think that's what you were responding to, that there might be something different about the kid, right?
There could be. I don't understand mental health and its complexity well enough to know how to tease things out. Because you could say that, I don't know, for instance, if depression is biological or social, or whether it's
doesn't
both.
Doesn't it have to be both? Doesn't it have to be both?
I suppose, but maybe I should put it this way. I don't know if the biological response can be social in origin, or whether it's just, you know, mm-hmm. something that's going awry in your system that produces these feelings. For instance, like postpartum depression, that's a hormonal change as far as I understand. I haven't experienced it, but that's what I understand postpartum mm-hmm. depression to originate with a biological change within. But I am pretty sure that depression can be a consequence of things that are happening out there, which could produce mm-hmm. changes.
Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, based on what you were saying before about Vygotsky and the secondary
disability,
that even if depression is biologically, has a biological origin, there's also then the secondary experience of how people relate to somebody
absolutely.
Who is depressed,
yes.
and the ways in which that continues the,
yes.
so I think, yeah.
So then I'm going to use an example because my daughter was a participant in research that one of my graduate students did on young women with what the term she used was depressive disorders. I'm quoting someone there, so. And one of the ways that my daughter became happy was to become involved in a community of practice that made her feel validated as a person. And this is a kid who had, you know, anxiety, depression, Tourette's, Asperger's. That's a real package, by the way, an oppositional defiance disorder. That is a really ferocious package. She was very unhappy. She was suicidal. I sat with her at the dinner table one night for an hour and a half while she ran a knife along her arm, wishing she had the courage to cut. There were some scary moments in our house, but she's a good artist, and she became involved in the online anime community.
Mm-hmm.
And she, through the drawings that she did, and we supported her. She was fortunate to be in a family that had enough affluence to support the technological need she had to participate in this community. So there's some little device, a tablet I think you call it, where you can draw on the tablet the images or become pixels on the screen. So she could draw and then have an image that she could work on digitally. And so this is a real Asperger's thing. She colored pixel by pixel. It's be so tedious for most people. But this is one thing, reason I think I can, that I'm successful with research, is that I can do things that would bore the hell out of most people in the detail work, you know, data analysis. But she puts me to shame in that category with some of the detailed work she does with art, digital art. But her involvement in this community practice, and I've come up with a metaphor of a positive social updraft, that this mm-hmm. engaged her in a cultural stream of practice mm-hmm. that lifted her up. That gave her a positive direction with her life. It gave her validation from all the other kids. You know, this international community of anime artists would talk about how great her art was. It gave her friends, because she had a lot of trouble with her face-to-face interactions. She was able to establish friendships online. And they wrote, you know what fan fiction is? And so kids collaborate on writing stories that are based on, that are essentially authored novels in a genre that they're familiar with. So they were all readers of Animorphs, which is a book series. So they would collaboratively write their own Animorphs novels. So to me, this community of practice gave her something to look forward to. And I think that was life-saving. So that is that's a great example of how the setting mm-hmm. can can change the way she thought about herself. She was, this was a place where she wasn't weird. This was a place where she was normal. And later she was in a program for young adults with Asperger's syndrome. And she actually hated it, but it was a place where everyone was just like her. And so nobody there was weird. They were annoying, but they weren't weird. And so, among other things, she could be around people like her when they were annoying and see what people meant when they said, you know, when you talk about Hooji Kooji or whatever, you know, some genre she was working with in anime, you know, for an hour, and her eyes glaze over, you have to be able to recognize that. And it would happen to her when listening to someone else talk about polar bears or something or whatever they were interested in. So, you know, this idea of being in this positive social updraft is, I think, really, it's compelling to me. And it's, to me, that's an adaptation of Vygotsky's idea of how you create these channels of activity that normalize people of difference and make them that feel as though they're valued members of society. And to him, this that kind of self-esteem was a central part of being of feeling validated as a person, not being given trophies, even if you're terrible, or even if you don't care. That's, yeah, you could be terrible, but if you work at it, that's maybe you get a trophy. But if you're terrible because you didn't work at it, you shouldn't get a trophy.
There's some people in the room who have whose either entire or partial life's work is in this field, and I was hoping some of them might
either share
that, or Christine, Aaron, Anne, you said you're a special teacher. I don't know, just...
Well, your hands up first.
I run a program called American Project in New York, and we create original pieces of theater through improvisation with kids on the spectrum, kids, teens, young adults on the spectrum, with other disabilities as well. I really respond to just the idea. I liked what you were saying about people feeling, you know, like when you're in an environment where even if you're around a group of people that all have autism, now our groups are inclusive. I mean, we incorporate siblings and other folks to really create an environment where people can just be, you know. Doesn't always work that way, you know, meaning it's not about being just among people that are like, but I think that's a big portion of it. And I liked what you were saying because it made me think about the idea that are out there of inclusion. Like, you go into an inclusion classroom and you will see anything a lot of times but what you would call inclusion.
Right,
there's a lot of time, right, but a lot of times you go into a program in some senses where majority of the people in some senses have a similar disability or extra ability or super ability or whatever you want to call it. Because I think they can be all of those things, you know. Sometimes they're disability, sometimes they are super ability in some senses. Sometimes it's what it really puts you over the heap. I think, you know, I always encourage the kids that I work with, people I work with, to know when to use it, you know? Like, hey, you want to get that on-time test? You're going to say you have Asperger's, and you're going to play it, dude. You know? And if you want, you know, because that's going to help you. You know you need it, so use it, you know? But if that gets in your way, and you go into a store, and you realize people are going to look at you really freaking weird, and if you have a big Asperger's thing printed over your face, you know? You don't want that, you know? So you have to know where you're comfortable with it. And I think that's, everyone has their own barometer on that. But I digress in the sense that I just think that that is actual real inclusion, what you're talking about with your daughter in some senses, because in some senses she's finding what her contribution to society is going to be in a group of people that are also thinking about that sort of thing. Yeah. So it doesn't matter if they're in a group of people that all are alike or not, it's that they're working towards the things that they're, at least in my groups I go, it's not everyone in my groups is passionate about theater, but they all know that they can come to a place and be themselves, and nobody's going to look at them twice
right.
because of it, and more likely they'll be celebrated for it.
Well,
and I think that's what sets we do on another, just because that's what we're going for.
And I've been around a lot of theater people the last couple of days, and I think that theater, music programs, it could be sports, they're an anime, there are many different kinds of activities that can serve these inclusive purposes. When I was a Little League coach, we had a kid who was clearly different from the other kids and was not embraced by the others, and I tried just as a coach to spend a little extra time with him. But when when I was a teacher, I don't think I'd have done a very good job of running an inclusion classroom because I didn't want to. I had no training in it. I had no understanding of it. There was no information, teachers have awfully difficult jobs as it is, and then kind of loading this. Oh, and by the way, we're going to put five kids with whatever in your classroom without helping you figure out what to do.
And they all have AIDS, and they're all different.
So there's a tendency to beat up on teachers for not doing a good job with it, but I think there's also a little bit of sympathy that I need to remind myself to direct toward them, because they probably haven't had any training, and then they point the finger at the teacher education programs as though we're supposed to in one semester provide teachers with everything that they'll ever need to know. I'm in that position all the time as a teacher educator. There was even someone who blamed things that happened 20 years later on teacher education programs as though there were no intervening experiences. It's a problem in that the job is so hard, and then a really hard thing gets handed to them.
When you were talking, it was making me think about this. this whole issue of categorization of Asperger's, non-Asperger's, atypicals, neurotypicals, and I actually had not thought of this for a really long time, but I remember a group that we did, a family group, and some of the kids had been diagnosed with Asperger's. Some of them were just a pain in the ass kids. They were having a hard time. And some of the kids had ADHD. That's what they came with, those things. And we played a game with the families were there. I remember the adults and the children were there. It was called, you're going to play the other. You could pick what the other is, but if you had Asperger's, that wasn't one of the things you could pick. You'd have to pick something else. If you were hyperactive, you'd have to pick something else. So it was like playing with the other, creating a, one boy, one girl show, or one family show of being the other, and the kids were really, really resistant to doing this. It felt very hard for them, and I thought maybe this is not a good thing to do. And so I asked anybody if they would volunteer, and this young kid, Henry, did. And he said that he could do the other, but it was 20 years later. So he would be then 30. So he came in, he opened the door in the therapy room, the other people are watching, they're the audience, and we're performing. And he says, this is a kid who had very kind of difficulty talking with ease. He was very nervous, somewhat rigid in some ways he was. And he comes in and he goes, "Hi, honey, I'm home. What's for dinner? Hi, Johnny, how are you?" And there was this thing, everybody was like, what? We've never seen this before. The hyperactive kids, some of them came in and they were just like really unbearably slow. Like they took an hour to sit down kind of thing. But people eventually grabbed it. I think that first boy he helped create the environment where it could happen. And the parents were saying, what the hell is this? What is this performance act? How did this happen? I don't know exactly how it happened, but it was what I was saying before, with performance and giving anyone the opportunity to perform something other, there was magic. It was magic. And there was, I thought, how I think about it, and I want to know what you think about this. I thought about it as we created a possibility. We added another something one could be, even maybe for a minute. But I was remembering this, and the getting rid of the categories altogether in a way, and something else happened when we got rid of them.
And that sounds like the conversation we had earlier today, because I had asked, can I assume that you're all familiar with what Lois does with the All-Stars? Because I really don't know how, but you just, like, we're walking by. I don't know what.
Offered a drink.
Lois was describing the All-Stars and their work, and we were over at the facility. And so I asked, are you trying to help them construct new social trajectories for themselves? Or maybe I asked
Dan and I together.
Dan, right. And it was not exactly, right, that was the answer. It was not, you know, that can happen. But it's more about imagining possibilities. You know, they don't have to become trajectories. You didn't have to become.
We weren't in any way going to even suggest that one should do that with them.
But they are formulating possibilities, yeah. Whether they follow them through or not. So did I get that right?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's what I'm hearing you say.
Yeah. But I think there's so much. I feel like there's so much more we can learn about that. There's just so much more we can do. I actually have forgotten that whole thing. Mm-hmm. You helped me remember.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's like I'm going thinking of what Peter said about himself and his daughter and others, which I've read some books written by people with Asperger's or autism, and the thing about how strange it is that the normal people do these weird things.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
How weird the normal people are, right?
Definitely.
And so what do you do with that? It sounds like you did something with that.
We played around with
it.
And also other desires of theirs came out. They were all they all decided to collectively they were in a very, very high-end hotel. These kids were 9 and 10. And they had room service. But there was something, that's where they went with it all. Like, it was a new day.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, what did they have Asperger's?
Yes, many of them did, and some of them didn't, and some of them had hyperactivity issues, focus issues.
Okay, so one of the things I think, at least this is what I say, because people tend to say, oh, you have Asperger's, you're sort of stuck with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
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 And I'll only speak for Asperger's because I'll tell you the kind of the textbook definition of Asperger's. And once oversimplified way is cognitively ahead, socially behind. So there tends to be higher intelligence, whatever that means, and immature, very immature social interaction skills. So smart people can learn things. And so one of the things I hear is that through these play activities, there's learning going on. So I know that I've taught myself, I've taught myself how to look people in the eye. I don't think I do that. I think I've taught myself how to be empathic because I don't consider myself to be naturally empathic. These are textbook Asperger's traits. So, you know, don't assume that because someone, you know, has something, that they're stuck with it in that form because people learn.
Yeah.
And so these plays, my daughter was in in a couple programs that she learned quite a bit from. One was in the Boston area, and it's called something like the Drama Play Connection. And the idea was that they learned social skills through play acting. Mm-hmm. And the woman who runs it is Dr. something with a Latina name. And it was a very good camp for her to go to. She was there 6 weeks in. But so that's just also something I'd always remind you of is to don't essentialize the person in the state that you find them in,
yeah.
Because they can learn.
Yeah.
And I find that very helpful and moving and feels connected to me to the, I keep going back to the secondary disability piece, because I was thinking in our society at least it feels like a secondary disability is that if you have a disability, that's who you are, right? So you're, whereas I wear glasses, but people don't think of me as that's the defining characteristic
right.
of who I am, and I can only do things that are glasses kind of things.
Right.
But people with Asperger's are often related to as that is the defining characteristic.
Yes.
So I was thinking about your daughter and the experience, the up, I love the visual of the updraft, the social
mm-hmm.
updraft, and that some of it is that you get into a community where that's not all of who you are. It's
there's
other things
that's
you
right.
have to offer, and
that's right.
so I find that one of the most painful parts of how we relate to kids or anybody is that it's not that that thing is going to go away necessarily, but it's one of many things. So I thought in your example, partly they had the experience of being something else.
Yes.
Not just related to as that thing, they had this other thing they
mm-hmm.
could do, so.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but I think also the idea of fixing, you know, this idea of fixing people, you know, and that this is what pervades most, this is the, you know, this is part of education, this is part of all of, you know, all, most things that we all encounter, any of us that have any kind of disability or a different way of being, is that you're usually constantly subjected to what's wrong with you,
mm-hmm.
and if
oh, yeah.
and you're being constantly told how to fix those things. So
mm-hmm.
even the idea to me of like, you know, I'm glad people have these social skills where they're supposed to get better at social skills. I would never profess to that any of my kids get better at social. They do, but that's not why they come. They come to play and they
mm-hmm.
come to create.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess what I think is that the deficit model is so ingrained in our system that we need to change, that we don't actually realize that a lot of times, as you said yourself, your deficits are ultimately what become your strengths and will end up fueling the rest of your life anyways. They not only become your livelihood, many times they become your profession. So the kid that has this narrow interest that everyone's saying, oh my God, you know, I mean, I can give an example of there's a girl in our group who's incredible, like the past couple of years, or first year she comes in, she's really into Julius Caesar, but Julius Caesar the man, not the play. Czars, tyrants, whatever. But you know, I mean, by giving her the opportunity to like embrace that sort of character, she really has taken ownership for a lot of stuff. And the other day she came in and she was late. She came in and she started, you know, she started saying all this Hitler stuff. It was like really intense. And like one of the little. This little guy, who's a little Jewish kid, it came up to me later. He's like, she starts going to the Hitler stuff. It really crossed my mind. Well, she calmed down later, and she looks at me, and she goes, hey, Aaron, you know, and group, you know, I'm really sorry I Kim Jong-un'd you all, you know. I was really sorry. I'm really sorry about that, you know. And I was like, hey, what was that about? And she's like, well, I just felt bad I was late, you know. But, like, but to be able to recognize it, you know, in some senses, like, I think so many times we're just trying to fix people and in some senses letting them be in their skin. A lot of times they find more recollection and more deeper things about their own selves if you just let them be, you know?
Yeah.
You know, and unfortunately we don't teach that, you know? So,
yeah.
What was the name of your group? Sorry.
The Miracle Project. The Miracle Project.
Miracle Project.
Yeah.
I was just thinking how I felt very given to when you talked about yourself too as an adult and all those, everything that you have and
mm-hmm.
that's all part of you. And also that was a little bit provocative, and we're saying how you were provoked. It was a little bit provocative at the beginning for you to be so open about it, but it was really lovely and
mm-hmm.
I like that and I appreciate that.
Well, one reason I have
yeah.
started talking about it and just being frank, I mean, first of all, I'm normalized.
Yeah.
But when I started confiding in people, not in such public spaces, but in, you know, one-to-one talking with people, the response was typically one of relief. Whew. You know, because they would feel less weird about something about themselves. And perhaps even the same thing.
Uh-huh.
Because we're so used to suppressing to not being honest about those things, as I'm sure I have been about many things in my life. So what I found that it's reassuring to people. So I've, you know, I'm, the reason I'm here is because I've had a successful career. And, you know, I'm not going to be, I'm not afflicted with false modesty about things like that. So when people hear me say, you know, look, I've had a meltdown in front of crowds, I take drugs to be able to give talks, I can't fly unless I'm doped up, you know, my house was a living hell for 18 years because my daughter was going crazy every night. They don't feel so, you know, it's like they feel less guilty about whatever it is that they are, or about their loved ones who are in the same boat that I'm in. And it's, you know, they often have a sibling, or maybe they're taking a medication. You know, I tell every class I teach, I know I'm not the only person in this room taking meds. Mm-hmm. And if you are, I'm always happy to talk to you about it, and this is a safe place for you. Mm-hmm. So that's one reason I've just made it almost, so I have this very autobiographical paper called Confessions of a Mad Professor, in which I talk about many of the things I've talked about tonight. And I use that as my introduction to my students now. Mm-hmm. So they know right up front, if they bother to read it, that I've, you know, I might look successful and all that to them, you know, standing up as an old guy in front of a class with a title of professorship, but that doesn't mean that it's been a cakewalk for me, and it doesn't mean that I still struggle to keep certain things under control, and that I can be a resource if and when things go bad for you. So I've ended up having students come to me. I'll give one example, and then, sorry, I'll get to the question. A guy, I forget, I don't think he was bipolar, but he was you know, working with something, and he said, I just don't think I can be a good teacher if I'm in this condition. And I said, you know, I think you might be the most valuable person in the school to kids like you, and there are a lot of them, because they tend not to have people they can confide in, especially if you're open about it.
I just wanted to say that by in speaking about yourself openly, it brought me into what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
In line with that, I was thinking of and you know when I just like psychiatric work. The homeless shelter teams, and I think that depression is the norm,
mm-hmm.
And it's related to and treated as out of the norm, as the unusual. But I think it's the norm in this culture, and the fact that people don't talk about it and relate to someone like you as special. I mean, you know, what I say to some of these kids is, you know, they're CEOs on antidepressants, and they're people functioning and living their lives and married and going to school on medication, and that is the norm. And there's no one that hasn't been depressed. It's this incredible, and the stigma is telling
you
that that's not the case.
Yeah, and you're seeing much better depictions in popular media of people on different spectrums. So I watched the last episode of the British Sherlock, and you know I'm a high functioning psychotic. That's why I'm so good.
You know? That's true.
And so you know there I think that and he's weird and he's difficult and he's obnoxious. But he can really solve crime. So, I mean, you know, I think that it does a nice job of showing that it's a mixed bag with a lot of good in it, no matter how much you might try your patience. And but lots of shows are now including less caricatured people, you know, across the mental health spectrum.
Yes, and a lot of people are going home from that.
and going...
Going home to nightmares, like he was describing. That it's not like everyone else is going home to a nice picket fence and
that's right.
Home. The people are, you know, people are having hard times and difficult lives. And the issues people, you know, that people feel very isolated and different rather than, you know, part of what's happening in our culture and in our communities.
Yeah, well, and I hope that the ones who do go home alone have online communities.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, there's sort of a, there's a tendency to look down on people who spend too much time on the internet, but
yeah.
I think it's saved my daughter's life.
Mm-hmm. It saves a lot of young people's lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, where do you fall, and this is the lowest question too, I mean, because I'm like this on label, you know, like labeling all the because to me, intrinsic in a lot of labels is deficit, deficit, deficit.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like this because I suck, you know, rather than I'm like, you know, deficit, you know, the label of deficit, the label of diagnosis, as well as, you know, potentially the other side of that. People who embrace, you know, by saying I'm a man with Asperger's, people, you know, or I'm a person with a potential deficit disorder, or whatever it is, a lot of people find strength. So we're, you know, I'm just curious in that dialogue.
So I'm not sure what the question is.
I guess the question is like, what, where, you know, when you started talking about deficit, you know, and this idea of a deficit-based kind of language model, way we think about things, and Vygotsky's kind of notion of, you know, that being like a lot of problems. So where does that fall in the labeling and the diagnostic kind of criteria and all that jazz?
Well, so why don't you take a shot? Because there is a point I'd like to make with that.
I mean, I think that a label is a label when it's a label, and a label isn't a label when it's not a label.
Mm-hmm.
So, what do I mean, we live in a linguistic environment in which everything is a label. However, you can talk in certain ways where what you're doing, even though you're using a label, is not labeling.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Peter's really conflicted about it, and he goes back and forth, which, as Christina's delighted by, and that's great, and I have no problem with it either. I'm thinking back to this study I did years ago. This was Ray McDermott and me,
mm-hmm.
and where we wrote about, after following through these videotapes, this kid who was, we didn't know he was diagnosed as learning disabled because we saw them in an after school thing. And what we did was we did notice that he was being related to in certain ways. So what we started to do was talk about the display of disability.
Mm-hmm.
That disability isn't a characteristic of a person,
mm-hmm.
but it is a socially organized display, and that this learning environment for him and his school and the society at large was organized for a display of a learning disability, which I don't think is the same as performance.
Yeah.
Well, I got you.
Yeah.
That's great.
It's not the same as what?
Performance. To me, I don't think the performance of a disability is the same as a display.
So I would give it, I think that's a compelling response. Mine's just very different, which is to think historically about how outsiders have been treated. So you think of a term like barbarian. It means outsider. It doesn't mean bad, you know rudimentary human
yeah.
being.
Yeah.
But that's how outsiders were characterized. They're barbarians.
Mm-hmm.
They're worse than we are. We've got to keep them out. And a lot of terms like vandals, I mean, that those were people, those, you know, the whole term vandalizing comes from this tribe of people. It, you know, historically, those other people have always been viewed as inferior to us. And it doesn't seem to matter which culture is coming in contact with which culture. And so this tendency to pathologize difference isn't new, it's not unique. If not American, it's what people do in order to, I think it's what people do when threatened.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this discursive construction of the other as inferior, threatening, bad, evil. And then it becomes institutionalized in our language the way barbarian has become. And so I think it's a human tendency that we can address. I don't think we're going to ever end it, but I think that we can at least in our own lives try to work against it, and those of us who write can try to persuade others to resist that human tendency.
And to let people know that they're to organize environments where every ordinary people can see, oh, that's what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Oh, I didn't know that. I didn't know you know what I mean? Like, people don't know. We don't have enough environments for people to have conversations about what do we do when we're speaking?
Mm-hmm.
What is happening? What are we doing? What kinds of pictures are we creating?
Mm-hmm.
That whole relationship between, the commodification, the fetishization of language and so on, that people think they think there's something that the words that are coming out of my mouth refer to. They don't refer to anything, but, you know, it's like a whole area of developmental education that I think is really important.
Yeah.
We have to stop.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.